It's now been almost 2 weeks since America voted. More than a full week since it became abundantly clear that Joe Biden would indeed be the next president of the United States. And no, the previous president has still not conceded. Allow me now to, and I'm sorry for this, but context is important, read to you a few of the social media posts that Donald Trump has made since the election was called for his opponent. Rigged election, exclamation mark. That's it. That's the whole post. We are winning by a lot, in all caps. The people will not accept this rigged election, exclamation mark. You get the general idea. But today's story is not about Trump's delusion. It's about the platforms that he uses to spread it. Heading into this election, Twitter and Facebook and Instagram all made a lot of noise about how they would handle disinformation, manipulation, and other election interference. So now that we're 2 weeks out from the vote, how did they do, and what will they do now and in the weeks to come? Because here is the thing, as much as all these platforms might want to get rid of the need to fact-check the claims of the president in real time and add disclaimers and warning labels to dozens of posts daily, this is a real business problem for them. Facebook and Twitter might say that they don't want to be the battlegrounds where elections are fought or disinformation is spread, but where would they be without it? There are a lot of people right now looking at Donald Trump's Twitter feed and wondering if the platform will suspend him or ban him once he's no longer president. But ask yourself, how much do you think that Donald Trump is worth to Twitter's bottom line? And what do you think would happen to that platform without him? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Jesse Hirsch is a researcher, a futurist. He is the author of MetaViews, which you can find at metaviews.ca. He's our favorite person to talk to about social media. Hello, Jesse.
Hey, Jordan.
Jesse, how did, in your mind, the major social networks do during the U.S. election?
I guess the easy answer is not bad, not good. I mean, they were certainly caught between a rock and a hard place, both when it comes to the pressure and expectations on the responsibility, but the extent to which they were the battleground, whether it was for lies and misinformation or legitimately to mobilize base, get out the vote. I think more than any election previous, social media was a real kind of fire pit of not just political organizing, but political deception. And I think that's also why there was so much attention placed on these companies, but also equally so much expectations for them to be responsible. And in that sense, you know, it's kind of a comme ci, comme ça. It was sort of right in the middle of not great, not bad. Could have been worse, but they could have done a lot better as well.
What do you look for when you log on to, let's say, Facebook or Twitter and try to figure out whether or not, I guess to use your term, the battleground is a fair place?
I think it really depends both upon the subjective experience. I mean, what I find interesting about your question is what you look for. I think everyone looks for different things on these platforms. I'm particularly interested in governance model, which both gets into how you deal with controversial topics. I think Twitter, to a certain extent, played a lead role in the way in which they added disclaimers or added information even to the president's tweets when it was misinformation. But the other side to this, of course, has been QAnon and the extent to which conspiracy theory not only played a big role in the election, but really was the driving force of a lot of social media activity, both good and bad. And this is where the social media platforms, I think, were the most interventionist or sort of tried to demonstrate the greatest amount of responsibility. But even then, I think critics are right to point out that it might have been too little too late, that the damage that was done, let's say, on Facebook or even YouTube by people organizing around QAnon and spreading the related conspiracy theories, you know, all of that, it was not just having the potential dangerous impact on the election, but it's going to be the legacy. It's going to be the kind of conflict or disunity, if you will, coming after the election that's going to make politics really messy, really vitriolic, you know, plagued with disinformation. And I think part of the responsibility for all of that lies at the feet of the social media companies who kind of incubated and nurtured a lot of the conspiracy culture.
Well, we've talked about this before in terms of what are these platforms actually responsible for, and what is their duty? And what I'm interested in your opinion on is where is the line, or is there a line between some of the disinformation that we saw from politicians, as you pointed out, going all the way up to the president, and the pretty obviously baseless QAnon conspiracy theory stuff? Because to me, on the outside, it looks like that line is at best like really blurry.
It is. And part of the problem is whether we think of social media as a utility, whether we think of it as a publisher, or whether we think of it as a company that has its own stake in the election. Because part of the pressure facing these companies is bias, if not the perception of bias. And where, you know, you and I, as people who have journalistic tendencies or straight out journalistic commitments, you know, we look at something like QAnon, and it is a fairly straightforward case in terms of, you know, being obviously false and disinformation. But conservatives, especially conservatives in the United States, have a different perspective, that when these platforms start to label QAnon posts or even remove QAnon from their platforms, then it becomes a kind of conspiracy against conservatives, or, you know, a political bias to these platforms that sort of skews their perception or skews their trustworthiness. And I think that that's where that line is not only blurry, it's entirely subjective. That different people see that line being appropriately or enforced in different places. And in particular, it was Twitter's handling of an article in the New York Post that, you know, this was an article that claimed it had hacked information about Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son. And Twitter banned the article from the platform, at least tried to do so by preventing people from sharing it. And while Twitter's logic was that it contained personal information because it was from a hacked account, that's why it shouldn't be shared, American conservatives perceived it as being an act of censorship, that they thought that Twitter was supporting the Biden campaign, that they were against the Republicans. And so it's that perception of bias that really muddies where that line is. And further, it's not just a legal line. In many cases, it's a moral line of sort of what is responsible in terms of these companies doing the right thing. And so all of that combines to it being not just muddy, but fraught with peril, and that you're going to upset somebody. So it's almost as if you have to choose who you're going to be upset in trying to then look as if you're taking the more responsible or ethical line in managing this.
When we talk about responsible and ethical lines, is it that, or is it a business decision? What happens if Twitter stands by its decision to ban that article and perhaps then bans the next one because there were a whole bunch of Hunter Biden conspiracies flying around out there? How long does it survive amongst conservatives?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, to your point, fundamentally, this is about business. And this is about Twitter not just being responsible to its shareholders, but being in a highly competitive industry. I mean, if you think of Twitter in juxtaposition with Facebook, with Google, with some of the other sort of players, especially TikTok as a Chinese-owned company, you know, Twitter's the kind of small player. They're the pipsqueak in all of this. And they've experienced the slowest growth. I mean, they're effectively stagnating when it comes to both user growth and revenue, especially compared to their peers. So ironically, the ethics and trust issues are about the bottom line. That, you know, in a media industry, trust is so crucial when it comes both to dealing with advertisers, because that is where all of this pressure is coming from, is advertisers don't want to be associated with extremist content. They don't want to be associated with conspiracy and disinformation. And fundamentally, that's why Twitter and Facebook and YouTube have been so aggressive in trying to combat QAnon, not so much because of politics or, you know, because of freedom of speech, but because advertisers don't want to be associated with that content. But at the same time, you know, to your point about conservatives, Twitter wants as many users as possible. So they don't want to alienate a third or half of the political spectrum in terms of the United States electorate. But they also feel a responsibility to their shareholders, to their advertisers, to, you know, offer a space that is somewhat conducive to advertising. So overall, it's a bit of a clown show in terms of both Twitter's attempts to appear responsible, but then in the end, really just being beholden to advertisers. So it's a bit of a paradox, especially when you consider that Twitter is the de facto town square, that it is where political debate happens, at least in the electoral or public sense. So I feel it's scandalous that the platform, you know, not only has an arbitrary enforcement to different kinds of political speech, but doesn't have a democratic governance model. That it, for example, doesn't allow users to themselves participate in moderation or an oversight of moderation, but instead still sort of relies upon automation and algorithms, which, as we know, is grossly ineffective and ends up just making huge mistakes, like the New York Post incident, in which it was algorithms that were sort of creating blanket bans on U.S. conservatives that ends up leaving Twitter looking as if they're not only irresponsible, but biased against their users.
I want to ask you to combine a couple of the things that you've mentioned. First is we've talked about the blurred line between real conspiracy theories and political disinformation. And the second is the role that Twitter and others play in determining what's fair and what's not. And where would you say this ends up if, you know, in the week after the election, we've seen some of the theories spouted by prominent Republicans move more and more towards the kind of things we would describe as a typical conspiracy theory? Like, at some point, do they have to shut down those accounts?
I kind of feel you're hitting the nail on the head. And it evokes both a slippery slope, both when it comes to Twitter's credibility, but also when it comes to politics or democracy as we know it. In that, on the one hand, there's kind of the, you know, political spin where you're trying to emphasize your position or get the best argument. And the other is outright lying and propaganda. What I think is dangerous about social media and dangerous about Twitter in particular is the power of the lie and the extent to which that lie can be amplified at a social scale, at a society scale that incentivizes lying, that encourages people to not just lie in a kind of propaganda or political spin way, but lie in a completely ludicrous, demonize your enemy way, which is part of what we're seeing in U.S. politics. And you know, as we speak, there are still very senior Republican officials who are trying to argue that Biden stole the election, that even though there's no evidence of electoral fraud, that electoral fraud happened at such a wide scale as to call into question the results of the election, that this is a whole new game of politics, both in terms of trying to delegitimize the Biden administration before it's even sworn into office, but in particular, the weaponization of social media and the way in which social media incentivizes extremism, you know, nurtures polarization and rewards lies. And this is something we've talked about for a long time. I mean, it's partly how, you know, the current president came to office was, you know, lies were part of his tool chest. And yet we've sort of talked about the extent to which social media platforms are not just complicit, but beneficiaries of that culture of lying. And I think that that is moving forward something that will get greater scrutiny, both in terms of how these platforms enable the liars, enable politicians to just say stuff that the rest of us go, oh my God, that's ludicrous. But that brings us back to the irony of subjectivity, that what is ludicrous to you and I is truth to other people. And how social media companies wade in or become the arbiters of that truth is not only something that they are really hesitant to do, but whether they have the authority to do it, I think, is an entirely different issue. And that's where conservatives in you know, really doubling down and in sort of presenting not just a worldview, but a methodology of lying at such a huge scale is something that I think we're going to have to deal with in the weeks and months to come.
Well, this is what I'm building up to. How do we deal with it? Does Twitter at some point, as this continues, given the precedent they've set with QAnon, do they have to suspend Donald Trump's account if it's like December 20th and he's still claiming that he's won the election and this whole thing is fake?
I mean, the short answer is yes. I think that there is certainly amongst those people who believe in the rule of law that there is a certain, you know, there can't be a hypocrisy. There can't be double standards, right? They can't be banning and silencing people who say things far less than what Donald Trump says. But to your point about December 20th, I think it's more, you know, in January when he's sworn in, that when he's no longer in office, you know, that's when the consequences of his flagrant lies, of his, you know, ludicrous speech patterns may catch up with him. But is it just Donald Trump, or is it, you know, as you mentioned, the other Republican officials? Is it the other people? Like, you know, does Twitter engage in a wholesale purge of all the people who sort of practice this kind of creative speech? I'm not so sure. I think this is where the law has to come in. And, you know, the social media companies have benefited from a provision in the Communications Decency Act in the United States from the late 90s that sort of meant that they weren't responsible for the speech that was on their site. I think that needs to change. And I do expect that the Biden administration will, at the very least, propose such a change. And that'll make it easier for these platforms so that they don't have to guess, but that line in the sand becomes a little more clearly defined from a legal perspective, at least a liability perspective, in terms of who's fundamentally responsible for some of the content or some of the quote-unquote speech that's placed on these platforms. But as you sort of inferred, I think it's going to get a whole lot worse before any resolution, or at least any motivation towards a resolution, emerges. And whether it's the conflict over this election or whether it's the conflict that emerges after this election, I think it's going to exacerbate both the polarization in society, but also the surrealness or the ludicrous nature of speech on social media as becoming even more inflamed and even more combative than it already is.
Here's my business side of the same question. How valuable to Twitter is having Donald Trump's account on the platform?
Well, I think that is the paradox, that it's incredibly valuable. I mean, you know, Twitter's business side certainly was suffering before Donald Trump won the presidency. And in using Twitter as the bully pulpit, in using it as the megaphone of the presidency, I mean, you could not have received a better gift. And it very much, you know, revived Twitter's fortunes, kept them relevant at a period in which they were not. I mean, I still believe TikTok is the current juggernaut, and TikTok is really, whether politically, economically, or culturally, you know, TikTok is still where the action is. So I think there's a lot of pressure on Twitter to adapt, to find some new way to keep the wind in their sails. I've been seeing a lot of talk online about Twitter buying Substack, which is the email newsletter platform that, especially during the pandemic, has been experiencing tremendous growth. And that is often the business strategy for these social media platforms, that when you stagnate, well, buy up a competitor and their trajectory, their growth ends up benefiting your own. But I think from a reputation perspective, you know, Twitter not only benefited from Trump, it benefited from being the battleground between conservatives and liberals, between the left and the right. Mm-hmm. And it'll be interesting as to whether Twitter maintains that, not just, you know, whether Biden chooses not to use Twitter as a bully pulpit, but whether politics just gets tired of the outrage culture, of the belligerent culture that I think has also marked Twitter in the Trump era. I mean, these are existential questions the company faces. And it's part of why, you know, I think they're receiving the kind of scrutiny they have, but I think they also anticipate it themselves. And it's why they've been investing in some really interesting R&D and really interesting investment in different technologies. Because I think they also see the writing on the wall that if they don't find a way to pivot or reinvent themselves, the post-Trump era may not be too beneficial for Twitter as a whole.
Here's the last thing I want to ask you, and I'm excited to do it because you're a futurist. And think of the conversation that we just had about how a presidential election was basically conducted and fought on the battleground of Twitter. And take yourself back 10 years and try to imagine having that discussion. And could you have foreseen this? Could anybody have foreseen this? And if not, what was the turning point that gave these platforms so much power in the public speech?
The easy answer would be that my homeboy, Marshall McLuhan, anticipated all this stuff way back in the 60s. And for those of us following his breadcrumbs, you know, it was to a certain extent possible 10 years ago to get a sense of the political influence that Twitter would have. I would admit that I would never have anticipated a president using Twitter in the way that Trump has. I think that eclipsed everything. But to your point of a turning point, I think it was the traditional media. I think it was when the broadcast media basically abdicated the kind of ownership of breaking news. That when all of a sudden, you know, CNN started to report on what was happening on Twitter, right? As soon as CTV and CBC right. started, you know, leading their newscasts with things that were happening on Twitter, you know, that's when Twitter became the media of record, right? When Twitter replaced the New York Times as the agenda-setting media, I think that's when everyone realized not just the attention power, but the political power that existed with Twitter more so than, say, Facebook or Instagram or YouTube. But, you know, there's no permanence to this stuff. And the way in which Twitter, I think, peaked perhaps months before Trump got elected, you know, that's where I think YouTube and in particular TikTok are ascendant right now. So it's easy for me to look 4 years into the future, or if you want, even 10 years into the future, and say where Twitter was really motivated by text and the simplicity of what was originally 140 characters, and of course has since doubled, but is still based on the zinger or the spin or the pithy little one-liner. You know, I think the future is a little more long form, but it's video. And that's why YouTube and TikTok continue to be the juggernauts that they are. And that's where I think political power is in the future. Because the same way that you could say that the president that the United States had for the last 4 years was really a reality television star, that it was his prowess in reality television. It was his ability to command Twitter as an attention-getting tool that really cemented his political power. Well, I think the politicians of the future are YouTubers today, that the politicians of the future are TikTokers today, not just because, you know, like the a reality television star, they're great at getting attention, but even more so, they're great at making the media themselves, right? Where Trump was a character on TV, but not necessarily someone who could make TV, the politicians of the future are also programmers as well as TV stars. And that's where YouTubers and TikTokers have a different kind of communication and political mobilizing that, quite frankly, I'm in awe of, and makes it very easy to predict that they're going to be the politicians of the future. You know, 10 years is perhaps even too long. It could come within 4 to 6.
Well, that terrifies me because we had a conversation right after the election with Jane Ledivadenko of BuzzFeed News, who debunks all the disinformation that spreads on social media. And she was talking about the tsunami of disinformation after the election. And what she said actually is that as it moves from text to video, it becomes exponentially harder to debunk because you can't find it. You can't perform the same kind of searches to systematically kind of root it out and see where it's spread. You can't search it for content and make sure that, you know, that bogus claim that was over here is now showing up here, et cetera, et cetera. And she said, like, the shift to video has made fact checkers' jobs almost impossible. So to hear you say that about where we're going, that's not great.
You know, on the one hand, I would concur with Jane in the sense that deep fakes have since become so accessible, so easy to do, that the shenanigans you can get into on video now, let alone in the future, are just going to become wild. But I would also anticipate that the auditing and the indexing and the inventory of video content that will be possible as a result of machine learning technology, you know, it may not achieve the kind of research or auditing potential that currently exists with text, but it will allow our friends like Jane and Craig some ability to sort of track some of that fake news stuff. So it's not that all hope is lost, but it is also, you know, easy to predict that conspiracy has become our new religion, and that these types of faiths, or even the jihads between different conspiracy faiths, will also become a staple of politics in the future, quite tragically.
The title of this episode is now going to be How Conspiracy Became Our New Religion. You realize that, right?
Quite fitting, I think.
Thanks so much, Jesse.
Thanks, Jordan.
Jesse Hirsch. You can find MetaViews at metaviews.ca. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. And yes, we are also on Twitter. We're not worth as much to the company as Trump is, but we got to be worth something. We got almost 3,000 followers on there. You can talk to us anytime, there or by email, thebigstorypodcast@rci.rogers.com. And of course, anywhere you get podcasts, you can find this one. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.